From the Jesuits of Canada and the United States, this is AMDG, and I'm Eric Clayton. There is a question that bubbles beneath the surface for anyone who is both Catholic and a writer. What constitutes a Catholic writer? There are a couple ways to come at this question, right? One answer might say that Catholic writing evangelizes. The Catholic part is obvious and in the foreground. But does this prioritize catechesis over craft? Another answer might say Catholic writing manifests beauty, inviting the reader into a world charged with God's grandeur, to paraphrase the Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. But then, what sets Catholic writing apart from just good writing? Another answer still might say that the religious persuasion of the writer is important to making Catholic art. But the Catholic imagination, one which is nourished by a sacramental reality, a world dripping with grace, can be something formed and sustained even without regular mass attendance. The answer, I think, is a lived one rather than a definition on the page. I think Catholic writers, Catholic artists in general, are each touched by God's Spirit in unique ways. They're each the fruit of their own unique spiritual journey. And this, of course, is to say nothing of artists formed by other faith traditions. Today's guest, my friend Gary Jansen, spends a lot of time thinking about this question. He lives at this intersection of faith and art. He's worked in publishing a long time, both at secular publishing houses editing Catholic authors, and now at Loyola Press, acquiring and mentoring authors that are writing for this Catholic publisher. Gary is an author himself. He's been on this podcast before, talking about his ghost-ridden memoir, Holy Ghosts, and his self-help book called Microshifts. In 2023, he won the Christopher Award for his children's book, Remember Us with Smiles, which he co-wrote with his wife. And those are just a few of his books. Well, he's back today to talk about his latest book of poetry and prose, Meditations at Midnight, a beautiful collection that, while not religious on its face, is certainly concerned with finding God in all things. Gary, you might say, embodies this question of what it means to be a Catholic writer, living at the crossroads of secular and spiritual, grace-filled and haunted, sacramental and profane. And if you too are fascinated by this question of the Catholic writer, I think you'll enjoy our conversation. Consider it our gift to you for this National Poetry Month. Here's my friend, Gary Jansen. Gary Jansen, welcome back to AMDG. How are you, my friend?
Oh, Eric, thanks so much for having me on, man. It's always good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you. Always good to have you on the show. And especially when you have a brand new book to talk about, Meditations at Midnight, Poetry and Prose, just out mid-March, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm very excited about this. It's a little bit of a departure from the stuff I've done in the past, but, you know, really excited that it's finally seen the light of day.
Yeah, I know. Well, I have some questions about your kind of journey as a writer, but I want to start, if you could just tell listeners about this project, because I know you had some very specific things in mind, and it's such a beautiful, it's a very approachable book, I just want, just kind of give us the elevator pitch. What was in your mind as you were dreaming this up?
Yeah, thanks so much. You know, I was an English major in college, and so a total book geek. I still am. I've been in publishing for more than 25 years now, so I love books and I love writers. And so back in 2019, I really wanted to do a book that was different than the nonfiction that I've written in the past, but something that was an homage to my favorite writers, right? And to try and take on their persona at times, and write from a different point of view. And I had studied poetry at college, and had a wonderful teacher named Judith Baumel, who was she's a terrific poet and such a fantastic teacher, who just retired a couple of years back. But she was a huge influence in my life. And so part of this was spurred on. We had reconnected about 2018, and some conversations I was having with her, and it just really kind of like, really, there's something inside me just felt something was moving inside me to produce something that was artistic. And my whole life I'd been wanting to do, I wanted to be that artistic writer. I wanted to be the writer who was, was writing literary fiction. But somehow I gravitated toward writing nonfiction and writing about spirituality and religion, but always trying to do it in a poetic way. And so this time I just wanted to collect, you know, some old poems that I had written with some new stuff and a couple of my old prose pieces that I wanted to throw in here and some new things as well. And to create something that was really artistic, different for me. And that was really kind of the inspiration. And I was a huge Hemingway fan, and I'd stumbled upon Hemingway's first book, which I thought was In Our Time. But even before that, In Our Time was his collection of short stories. But even before that, he did a small little book that I think was only about 500 copies were printed, and it was called 10 Poems and 3 Stories, or 3 Stories and 10 Poems. I have to go back and take a look. But 10 Poems and 3 Stories. And I was like, wow, that's great, this collection of poetry and prose. And so Meditations at Midnight, which is the same collection, same type of collection of poetry and prose, is really inspired by that Hemingway work.
Yeah, I love a book that you can just pick up and just, I think you even say this in your description, you can just read a little bit. You know, you can kind of open it up and just be a little bit, be a little inspired. And I like that a lot. I think this book is approachable in that way. Can you talk a little bit more about, like, what were some of the questions that you were wrestling with in this book, as you were writing, but then just as you were kind of dreaming about it, this desire in you to produce something like this? What were those questions?
Yeah, I think for me there were themes of just. So some of the themes that are really big in the book is betrayal, and how we deal with disappointment, but also just really like questions about our everyday existence, why are we here, what's our purpose, what am I grateful for in life? And the poems and the stories really kind of reflect this. And there's a really like, it's a book in 5 parts, and it was arced in a very, very specific way. And I did my master's degree on Dante and John Irving, actually. So John Irving and Dante. So did a lot of work and studied for a little bit in Rome, not Rome, in Florence, when I was doing my master's, just to really get the feel of Dante and his Florence. And so the book itself really, it sounds so crazily pretentious, but it really kind of arcs in the way that the Divine Comedy arcs, which is, Dante's Divine Comedy is a really long poem that travels from in the Inferno, from hell, to purgatory, to paradiso, and to heaven, right? And so there's this arc in 3 parts, and really the first 3 parts of Meditations at Midnight follow that completely. So the first part is something called Via Dolorosa is part 1, which translates to the Way of Sorrows. And so that first part is really my look at the passion, right? And themes of betrayal, themes of disappointment, themes of uncertainty about the future, and again, one of my big inspirations was Wallace Stevens, and he had a poem called 13 Ways at Looking at a Blackbird, and that first section, Via Dolorosa, is 14 poems, so it's a 14 poem arc, and it's kind of 14 ways of looking at Christ's passion, but it's written in a way where I talk a little bit about God, but it's hopefully it touches on universal themes, so that someone who may not be a Catholic or a Christian can pick it up and at least get a sense of what's going on and experience of it, even if they're not picking up necessarily on some of the inside baseball things that are going on in terms of the word.
I know. I remember you telling me about this as you were working on it, and so I immediately brought that like Way of the Cross lens to it, to that beginning. I loved it in that approach because, like you said, there's so many Easter eggs in this book and so many different ways to engage with it. And I forget. I remember you can tell us now. You tell our listeners. You have constellations, right? And each that kind of separates each section. Can you talk about what those signify?
Yeah, absolutely. So. So when you get the book, I really wanted the book to look beautiful and to have a really particular feel to it. And so if you hold it in your hands, it's small. It's really, again, an homage actually to City Lights poetry books. So City Lights is this great bookstore and publishing house in San Francisco, and they publish Allen Ginsberg's Howl, Jack Kerouac, who is Jack Kerouac's poetry, and and so many others. Lunch Poems was published by City Lights, and so they're these small, compact poetry books. That you just kind of like throw in your backpack or take with you. And I love the feel of them. I love their size. And so the book itself kind of mirrors what City Lights has done in the past. But there's this spot art that moves throughout the book. And Via Dolorosa, which is part one, again, kind of the Way of Sorrows. There's a piece of art in there that's really, it's the constellation of Aries. Or the ram, and there's a so that overarching symbol is that since it's about the passion, it represents Jesus as the adult lamb, the ram. It harkens back to Abraham and Isaac, and it's also many medieval folks from Thomas Aquinas to Dante believe that Jesus was crucified under the constellation of Aries, and so I wanted to like add that kind of like Easter egg right in there, that this level that if you get it, it's awesome, right? It's like, oh, that what a check out that connection. And if you don't get it, well, it's a really kind of a cool looking piece of art that you can, really kind of apply whatever else is going on there. And then the second part, which kind of follows the Purgatorio or the Purgatory, that's Aquarius. So the constellation is Aquarius, and it's often referred to as the libation bearer. And someone who is giving drink to the thirsty, right? And this idea of life as this purgatorial experience that happens. That's kind of the part two is just like these short little stories, almost these Zen stories about just dealing with life. But it is this kind of wandering that's going on in terms of seeking out our purpose. Why are we here? Asking those questions. And so I just loved that we were able to kind of like take these little pieces of art. That have really, really clear representation and just builds on the different levels of what we were trying to do with the book.
Yeah, I think just engages the imagination, right? In that more creative way, you're engaging different senses and different parts of the, just again, just the mind. And I think it's really powerful, especially as you kind of, look at this book as a in a prayerful way. And I know, obviously, I know you're a prayerful guy, and you're also an editor, so you're thinking about, faith and writing all the time. But I wonder how, for this book in particular, right, coming at this intersection of faith and writing as an editor versus coming at this book, coming at this idea of faith and writing as a writer, how is that different in your mind, or is it not? Is it kind of a very seamless process?
Yeah, it's so part of the reason why I think it takes me so long to write a lot of times is because I'm editing as I'm writing, right? And so as I'm going along, I might come up with a line or a paragraph and go, oh my God, this is terrible. And just keep working it and working it until I get to a certain place where I'm happy with it, instead of me being just kind of a free flowing through. Now, I've done it in the past where I've just kind of, I'll write through, I'll come back and I'll edit. But there's always that editor, which is one of the toughest things actually when you're a writer, to kind of turn off the editor when you're trying to create, because it can. I was really fortunate to interview John Irving really early on in my career. And one of the things that he said about himself was that he was a terrible writer. And I remember saying to him, like, no, you're not a terrible writer. You're a great writer. He said, no. I'm a terrible writer, but I'm an amazing rewriter. I'm paraphrasing. And he said, really, the art, the book comes out in the rewrite. And it's really important for you to just, he was also very structured. So he would use an outline. It was very structured in the way that he would produce his stuff. But the reason why it took him years and years to get books out and to produce books was because he was constantly going back and refining and refining and refining until really the publisher, I'm sure, was like, you have to get this book in now. We got to go to press. So I think it's hard for me to separate the two when I'm doing it. And also like a book like this, it's yeah, I mean, I think one of the best things that an editor can do is not necessarily tamper with like good writing. Is just kind of like let the writer be who the writer is. Even if I was to look at a line and say, hey, you know what? I would probably say it like this. It doesn't matter. It's can I help you say it better in your own way? So I think, you know, it's, you know, full disclosure, I help, you know, edit Cannonball Moments, right? And so there are times when I would ask you, right, and just in terms of the editorial process, hey, you know what, can you expand on this? I want you to like rethink this, you know, this line, and really put the onus back onto the writer to let them be the creative person that they want to be and to keep out of it. Though I think one of the most important things for an editor is to, how are you arcing the story? How are you arcing, even if it's nonfiction, what's the arc? Should this come first? Should this come second? So for me, it's really moving like big pieces around. That's the thing that jives me the best because, you know, I love like having, you know, even if it's just an Easter egg pattern, like in the background saying, hey, you know what, why don't you use this book or this work of art as your inspiration and then, you know, build on that. So you have this skeleton that's sitting in the back. It's kind of like bass lines in music. That's just kind of, it's follow. It's helping you move from one piece of music to the next. And so, yeah, so I think that's, you know, in terms of editing and writing, all of that comes into play when I'm creating. And yeah, and the editorial process can be really a wonderful creative process as well.
Yeah, I often think about editing in some ways as akin to spiritual direction, right? Like a good editor is going to pull out of you kind of what's already at work within, as opposed to, you know, obviously a bad spiritual director tells you what God is doing or what God wants, but a good spiritual director is going to walk with you and accompany you to discover God already at work. And I think that's, I don't know, the more I write and the more I edit and I work with editors like yourself and our mutual friend Vanita and others, I think there's that sense of like, oh, like, am I allowing kind of God through these words to manifest in the way that God's already desiring to be there, as opposed to, you know, being really heavy handed.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I was a horrible spiritual director / editor in the very, very beginning, because I would rewrite like folks, you know, work. So I'd get this, you know, when I first started, I was like, yes, I'm in there. Like, what am I going to do? You know? And I remember, I'm embarrassed by it now, but essentially rewriting like someone's work, one of the first books I got, and feeling years later just really embarrassed about having been as forward in terms of thinking, hey, you know what, the author can't do this. And it was being young, it was being stupid. He obviously chewed me out for all the work I had done. So I learned my lesson then. But he did teach me a very, very like clear lesson about, you know, you have to let the writer be who the writer is going to be. So that's really important.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's finish like pulling that thread some more, because I wonder how you see this book fitting into your own vocation as a writer. Because as you said, it's a departure from what you've done in the past. Now, you've done a bunch of different kinds of things in the past. You've written kind of memoir, you've written spiritual books, you've written children's books. I think some of your like your micro shifts, that's kind of almost like a like inspirational, kind of like a little self-helpy, right? Self-help. So you've hit all these different genres. So how do you see, are you responding to kind of God within you as a writer, you know, as a vocation, or are you, do you have in your mind, like, this is where I want to go next? This is the next, you know, challenge. How are you seeing this unfold?
Yeah, I think for me, it was really just that desire always. And I feel like in all the works that I've done, whether it's been writing the children's book that we did with a couple of years ago called Remember Us With Smiles, or even the self-help stuff like I did with Microshifts, is the, there's always kind of an artistic element in it, right? And there was always this, there's something behind each of the books where it wasn't, now when you're writing nonfiction, now, there's some people who do amazing creative nonfiction, right? And it's just their, you know, they are artists. And but a lot of times, at least for me, I'll just like talk for me, I just want to get the ideas across when I'm writing a lot of nonfiction. I want to make sure I can build bridges, build connections, and make things very clear. And I think the writing was secondary, though at points throughout all the work that I've done, it was very important. But I think primarily it's like, let's get the ideas out, and let's put the focus on that. And the writing was secondary. For me, the writing is primary on this one. And so I've been getting some really like nice responses, and you know, from, you know, we did like a Goodreads giveaway, right? And you know, you get, and Goodreads can be very snarky, and so we got some. I got some really decent reviews on there from people who were like, "Hey, you know what? I like this, and I'm not really sure I knew what was going on, but I enjoyed it, and I felt really calm and peaceful at the end." And I went, well, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to create something. It's called Meditations at Midnight, and I call it kind of a love letter to insomniacs. But it is something I wanted people to like read maybe before they go to bed, right? Just to open it up and like read something. And maybe that helps them trail off, or maybe it brings them a sense of calm, or maybe it, you know, maybe it keeps them up for a little bit, just because it makes them question something. So I think for me, I think it was responding to a call to try and be a bit more artistic and creative, because the creative process is a godly and divine process. And I think we're all, you know, in our faith, we're called to be co-creators. And we can do that through art. We can do that through the work that we do. We can do that working in construction or driving a bus. You know, we're constantly creating the world around us with, you know, co-creating the world around us. And so I think that from a very, since I started writing, I think I've been called to try and do something that was more artistic, or do something that was artistic, that would be a celebration for God. So I really do like, you know, as much as this is dedicated to my family and to my mother-in-law who passed, this really is a book for God and me.
Nice. That's beautiful. Yeah. I also like, I feel like I never would have thought, I want to write a book that helps people fall asleep as like a good thing. But I was reading a story last night that I didn't realize it was like a horror story. It was a short story. And I was like terrified as I fell asleep. I was like, this was a terrible idea. So it is a real gift to like bring that peace to somebody, even if they're drifting off, you know, between words. And I think that's a cool goal. I'll have to think about that.
And I think part of that came out of also like just being a huge fan of like the Halo app and like the Calm app. And there's stories on there. In the beginning, I'm like, oh my God, there are actually like sleep stories in here. How embarrassing for the author that, you know, you're reading something that's putting someone to sleep. But then I loved them, right? And I love the stories. And yeah, they keep me up for a little bit, but there was something very relaxing that brought me to like a new state, and I would just fall asleep. So part of what I wanted to do here is not to put people asleep in a bad way, like, oh my God, this is so bad, and throw it across the room. But to experience a sense of midnight, right? That kind of like in between state between, you know, being awake and falling asleep.
I love it. Perfect. All right. Well, why don't you give us? I mean, I want you to choose a section that's going to keep people awake, because if you want to be driving in their cars, you know, we don't want them to doze off now.
That's right.
Put a disclaimer. But maybe you can pick a short section to read to give people a taste, and then I'll ask you to kind of like reflect on what that particular part means. But why don't you go for it? Tell us what we're going to hear.
Yeah, sure. So this is from Via Dolorosa, the part one, and it's called Father and Son. And this one is really a poem about Jesus and Didymus, right? And Didymus is the saint who was the thief, the penitent thief, right, who is crucified with Jesus on Good Friday. So this is Father and Son. You look into his eyes. You never had a son, but you wish now you could be a father to this man. He was unexpected. You thought you were journeying alone. Didn't expect this chosen one to be your companion into the next life. God of surprises, God of mercy. My son, you say, today we travel light.
Beautiful. Well, I love that. And also, did you do the audiobook? Because your poetry reading voice is very soothing. So maybe we should put some nighttime stories here.
I think we're trying. It's possibly in the works. And if we have time, I would love to try one other one.
Please. Right. Let's do it. But then you have to tell us why you chose both of them, the significance of both.
So. Absolutely. So that was a religious poem, right? And so it really is like, and in the first part, really a lot of the poems are Jesus is really imagining a very Ignatian way putting myself in the scene. And but putting myself in the scene as Jesus a lot of times. And so a lot of the early poems are from the point of view of Jesus, right? Reflecting, whether it's reflecting as he sees Judas approach him, or reflecting as he stands, or, you know, as he's going through the day of the Passion. So yeah, so that was that part. And this other part comes from Via Cordis, which is the way of the heart. And so these are love poems, I guess, in some ways. And one of my favorite poets was this guy named Charles Simic. And Charles Simic was a Serbian poet who came to live here in the United States. And I just loved his stuff. And he wrote a book called Hotel Insomnia. And it's a lot of absurdist poetry and a lot of like weird images. So this is written for him. And so this is called Simic Country, for Charles Simic. Coming in out of the rain last night, I drank 10-year-old Black Label with Pythagoras while he explained on an abacus all I ever wanted to know about the transmigration of souls. Archimedes and Galileo in tank tops and jeans sat at the end of the bar, discussing displacement and buoyancy over shots of Jägermeister, while one of Bach's sons, the one with nine fingers, played Alexander's ragtime band badly on a Yamaha upright. It was then I saw you standing, half hidden in lager light, playing darts with a skeleton with eyes of mother of coal. And all I wanted to do was wrap you and me in a cocoon of Syrian silk and play strip poker until we grew one set of wings.
Nice.
Thanks.
Nice. All right, so why don't you tell us a little bit about both those. You gave us kind of an introduction to the last one there, but maybe tell us kind of what you're hoping a reader steps away from with those particular ones.
Really images. And so I think, you know, I studied linguistics in when I was doing my master's, and it kind of ruined me as a writer, because one of the lessons that I learned from linguistics was, Do you get your point across? Doesn't necessarily have to be grammatically correct, but can you get your point across? And if you are, then you're touching on a different part of language than kind of, you know, what I do for a living, which is make sure the grammar is good, make sure the paragraphs are all lined up. And so what I wanted to do is really in this book was to create a bunch of images, and because the image is so important, and pictures are worth 1,000 words. And I really do think that if you can create an image and create an image with words, then it really allows for more of a creative engagement with the reader. If you can do it successfully and get it across, and then I really think all of a sudden there's a bridge that happens, and it's a mystical bridge. And really this book itself is supposed to be a mystical experience at the end of the day. Like readers read it, hopefully, and maybe, you know, maybe the words don't move them, but something moves them, right? And they're having, and I want them to have that kind of mystical experience. So when I was writing the Simic Country, he would write a lot like that in terms of like weird images and kind of pulling in, you know, encounters with historical figures who died 1,000 years ago. And so that was really my homage to him. And even though he may have been an atheist, I don't know if he was or not, there was something very mystical about like his writing. And a really quick story about Charles Simic. He was grew up during World War II, grew up in Serbia, which is Yugoslavia, and really a lot of his poetry is about folks who are being kidnapped. He grew up in a time during the secret police would come invade, or the Nazis were, or the Russians, or, you know, all of these places or all of these countries that are trying to like take people away. And so he was a nervous guy, and there's a certain level of paranoia that's in his poetry. Well, I'm walking in New York City years ago, and Rizzoli Bookstore is this big bookstore in New York City. And I was just reading the night before Hotel Insomnia, which is one of Charles Simic's big books. And who walks out of Rizzoli but Charles Simic, right? What? And now he's a poet, No one knows what this guy looks like. I know what he looks like.
You do.
I know what he looks like. I was reading his book the night before. And I get so excited. Like, I'm like a school kid. And I'm like, Charles Simic? Charles Simic? Is that you, Charles Simic? He gets so scared that I think he thinks I'm like the Stasi or the secret police. Finally, like, you know, the secret police has finally tracked him down. And he got really, really nervous. And I said, oh, I'm a huge fan. You know, I just was reading Hotel Insomnia. And he's like, oh, that's great. That's great. I gotta go. And he ran away.
How could I get out of this situation faster?
Oh my goodness. I didn't mean to scare the poor guy, but I must have been, yeah. So anyway, that's my Charles Simic story.
So I guess the lesson there is you have to really, it's good to know the biography of people before you like fanboy over them so that you don't, set off a panic attack. That's awesome. You know what I hear? And I hear you kind of just saying as through this whole conversation is, you know, obviously, you know, we're both in the Catholic tradition, right? And so we talk a lot about saints and going to God together and kind of, you know, building upon, the mystical learnings of folks have come before us. And I hear that a lot too in the writing. And obviously this book, you said, is an homage to writers that affected you. But I think for all writers or all creative folks, like it's in some way, in a similar way to, you know, kind of the communion of saints, there's this kind of sense of a communion of creative people that we're all kind of building something together, you know, kind of carrying the baton. I don't know. Does that image work for you? Does that sound right? Or am I
love that. Yeah, that's beautiful. The whole, the community of saints and writers. And I think, you know, I do think like there are reading, I guess, for me and writing, and I'm sure this is for you too. There is a certain level of a mystical experience when you're doing it, right? And there's a, you know, because you're using your creative imagination. When you're reading something, we don't think of it this way, but we are using our imagination, right? We have to make that connection, especially if we are reading something and it creates a picture, right? Or you're trying to create a lesson. You know, you're using words to help facilitate an idea, to create an idea. And there's something very, very mystical that's going on at that point, especially like, you know, like when you read, I still remember, I'm in fifth grade reading The Hobbit for the very first time.
Yeah.
And there's stuff going on in The Hobbit that I didn't know about at the time. Now I look back at it and go, oh, wow, so Tolkien's doing this and he's doing that and he's doing this. And I felt it. I didn't know it, but I felt it. I felt something. And that still resonates with me today. And so I think, you know, I do think that there's a collective, you know, communion of writer saints out there. I mean, this book is like filled with, you know, the spirits of like Jack Kerouac and Charles Simic and Hemingway and Judy Balmel and Anne Sexton and Emily Dickinson and, you know, Paulo Coelho and all of these writers that I've loved so much. And so they're definitely their spirits and their, you know, the mystical experiences that I had in the reading of their work really still resonates with me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think to take those images to my own prayer a little bit and think more on that, because I think there's a lot there to unpack. Last question, maybe turning the tune a little bit, but obviously you are the acquisitions editor, among other things, at Loyola Press, and so I want to know a little bit with your editor hat on, what are we looking for right now in Catholic publishing? What's missing that you hope. You know, we're talking about the importance of writers and the importance of, continuing to build something new. What are you on the lookout for today that you're hoping to, you know, this niche of publishing really could benefit from?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, and it's really, it's so tough to answer. But for me, it's more about a quality, and I think a lot of it is just the energy, right? And one of the reasons why I loved your work so much, your work is, you know, from Cannonball Moments and My Life with the Jedi, and also your blogs and your podcasts, there's a real energy there. And again, it's this creative energy and this, and desire to want to connect with others. So I think for me, it's really like looking for stuff that has this pizzazz to it, this energy, this not, and it doesn't mean, you know, it's not necessarily even youthful energy, right? I've gotten a manuscript in, I can't go into great detail. It was written by someone in their 60s, and it's the first time, you know, they've written the book. And you're just like, wow, this is like really like exciting stuff going on here. So I think it's really, a part of it is being, I love personal works that take a step back, right? And so, you know, we can, you know, a friend of mine talk about this. So let me just take my journals and put it into book form. I'm like, yeah, you could do that. Or you might just want to like take your journals and then edit them, take a step back and look at them a little bit differently with kind of an observer's eyes and see what you get out of it. I'm sure there's definitely good stuff in there. But so I think part of it is like just having an energetic spirit, folks who are looking at things in a almost a countercultural way or counterintuitive way. Let me say it that way. Counterintuitive in that, you know, if I say, you know, the banana is yellow, the banana is yellow, the banana is yellow. Well, that's okay. But if someone says the banana, I don't know, looks like it's the worst. I mean, it looks like a school bus. Okay, that's a little bit better, right? Or, you know, or a banana looks like, I wish I'd come up with something better.
The banana is a telephone to a different world where only fruit can be people. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I went down a bad alley with the banana idea. But I think the idea is, can you come up with something that grabs people's attention, right? They've heard so much. We get bombarded with so many words, thoughts, opinions every day, especially if you're on social media, that words can end up becoming like really, really cheap. So is there a way of you looking at your faith, right, and writing it in a counterintuitive way and approaching your life in a counterintuitive way? So, hey, you know what? You think you're going to go down one path. And Billy Collins was actually, who is poet laureate for the United States. He gave me a great lesson because I was able to workshop with him for a little bit. And it's called The Turn. And so this is something, if you're a writer out there, there's a book called The Triggering Town, which is not written by Billy Collins, but which he recommends. And in it, there's an essay called The Turn. So it's, and I try to do that a lot in Meditations at Midnight, which is, hey, if you're going to talk about something, at a certain point, turn and go like 180 degrees the other way. You know, so a classic like Billy Collins poem will be, oh, I look out the window and I see my dog playing in the backyard and I watch the ball, you know, and I watch him play with the ball that he's loved for so many years. And the ball is red. And it reminds me of the time when I saw your painted nails, you know, and you were waving goodbye to me and they were red and I never saw you again. So, you know, there's just a turn where he's looking out there, he's having this observation. He sees the color red. He sees his dog so happy. And then that color red does what does to us naturally. It can create a memory of something else and then pull that connection in, right? So you, then all of a sudden, instead of it's an observation of a dog playing with a ball, all of a sudden it becomes a poem about someone that you've lost, right? And the last thing you remember is her red nails. So that, I think, is something to like keep in mind. The idea of the turn, like how can you approach that if you're writing about spirituality or you're writing fiction or nonfiction? Where are the turns? Where can you go down one alley but make a connection that takes you down something else, right? And then all of a sudden, you're like, well, where am I? I wasn't expecting that, right? And the unexpected, I think, is what grabs people, which is why I think, again, coming back to your book, My Life with the Jedi, it's an unexpected book, right? You're drawing these like bridges and these comparisons from Ignatian spirituality to the Star Wars saga and the mythos, and you did such a wonderful job with it. I love that it's unexpected. It's just an unexpected book. And that's one of the reasons why, I mean, I love your work and what you do, because whether or not you're doing that on purpose, you're definitely doing it, and I love that.
Thank you. I'm glad I asked the question so you could promote my stuff. That was
a great
promote
your book, right? And it was completely honest.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Obviously you've helped me with all of it, so I really appreciate it. And I like this. Something else, I have to look up that book and read those essays, because I think what you just described in so many ways is the spiritual life, right? We're talking about spirituality, right? We should be surprised by these like turns we take. So, my friend, it's always a delight to talk to you. Where can people get Meditations at Midnight and learn about your other work now that they're so inspired?
Yeah, so check out my website, GaryJansen.com, for further information about me. But you can get the book on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. You can order it at bookstores.
That's awesome, man. Congratulations.
Thanks.
All right, Gary. Until next time.
Excellent. Thank you, Eric. God bless.
AMDG is a production of the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the United States, and recorded at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. This episode was edited by me, Eric Clayton. Our theme music is by Kevin Lasky. The Jesuit Conference communications team is Mike Lasky, Marcus Bleach, Megan Leipsch, Becky Sindelar, Kristen Smith, and me, Eric Clayton. Connect with the Jesuits at jesuits.org and on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Get our weekly email reflection series, Now Discern This, by visiting jesuits.org/weekly. If you or someone you know would like to learn more about becoming a Jesuit or Jesuit life in general, connect with your local vocation promoter at beajesuit.org. Drop us an email with questions or comments at media@jesuits.org. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, as St. Ignatius may or may not have said, go and set the world on fire.